You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. My guest today is Larry Diamond. He's a senior fellow here at FSI and at our Center on Democracy Development and Rule of Law, as well as a senior fellow at their Hoover Institution. He is known to some as Mr. Democracy, most certainly to me he is, because of his work on democracy. I think probably, if not the most prolific person on democracy over the last 30 years, at least top three or one of them. And that's why I was surprised, I want to tell you honestly, Larry, when I heard you are writing another book after so many books that you have written. The book was just published this summer. It's called Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate your having me.
So let's start with why in God's name. I think I have 30 books that say authored or edited by Larry Diamond in my office. Why did you decide or feel compelled to write this particular book?
Well, the answer is very simple. I think we're at a unique and potentially profound turning point in world history, Mike. What I describe in the book is a possible hinge in history, where the post-Cold War world that's been dominated by liberal values, liberal in the sense of liberal democratic institutions, and a strong normative prevailing consensus and global diplomatic and institutional momentum for freedom, democracy, rule of the law, human rights, and all these other values that are so fundamental to who we are as a people, this is coming to an end, or at least it's under severe challenge from Russia, China, Iran, and from many countries that were until recently democracies or are in danger of soon no longer being democracies. So I felt we were in a new and urgent situation that required a kind of focused analysis and a strong set of recommendations for how to climb out of the hole that we are sinking into.
Well, congratulations. It's a great book. I've read it. I hope many others will read it, policymakers and citizens around the world alike. Let's start with the macro picture that you start with. And it describe for our listeners a bit about what you call the democratic recession, although you just told me that maybe we should begin to talk about it as a democratic depression. What's going on in terms of trends around the world?
Well, during the period from 1990, with the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then shortly thereafter the fall of the Soviet Union, until around 2006, we witnessed an unprecedented expansion of democracy in the world. The percentage of states that are democracies rose from about a quarter to over half of all the independent states in the world. That had never happened before. Wow. In world history. And the number of democracies in the world, with many new countries coming into being, the pure number of democracies in the world tripled during this period. And we thought we were on an almost irreversible roll. I hate to trot out the term end of history, but you get the point.
I think you had a book called The Global Resurgence of Democracy.
Yes, that was
time,
an
right?
early oh, entry no. into this period of great optimism.
Yeah, it was very exciting, right?
About the expansion of democracy in the world. Since 2007, the statistical trends have at least partly reversed, and we have now had, according to Freedom House, 13 consecutive years in which more countries have declined in their levels of freedom, that is, political rights and civil liberties, than have improved, exactly reversing the prior post-Cold War pattern between 1991 and 2006. And in addition, the rate of democratic failure has been accelerating, and we see big and strategically important states like Turkey and Venezuela, Russia, of course, in the early years after Putin's rise, Bangladesh, and many others that are retreating from democracy. And we even have a case of, I'd say, outright retreat, not only from liberal democracy, but from democracy itself, in the case of Hungary, with pressure in the wrong direction in Poland, with democracy hanging from a thread in the Philippines. So, Mike, I wouldn't say it's a depression now, but what worries me and what helped me to inspire me to write the book was the, I think, growing evidence that we could be on the cusp of a democratic depression, or what Huntington would have called a third reverse wave of democratic breakdowns.
That's depressing. Help us understand what you think some of the causes are. Is it the three things you mentioned in the subtitle of your book, or is there more going on?
Well, first of all, let me say what I think the four authoritarian ill winds are, because
okay.
I could only squeeze three of them.
Oh, your editor wouldn't let you have a fourth one in there?
You know what they say about three being a better, more memorable number.
Yeah, well, let's walk through those first.
Let me walk through what's happening, and then we can talk about why it's happening. First of all, I've already spoken about Hungary and about the rise of a more illiberal, authoritarian, populist mode of governing and of politics in Poland as well. And the anti-immigrant wave throughout Europe, even Western Europe, with the rise of the National Front, Brexit, and other illiberal anti-immigrant parties like the Sweden Democrats,
right.
And Alternative for Germany, which is not a neo-Nazi party, but has neo-Nazis in it,
uh-huh.
And which is poised to make further pretty dramatic electoral gains in the elections that are coming this fall in Germany. So I think the first ill wind is that we've had for some years now a rising trend of incremental authoritarianism, step-by-step suffocation of democracy, usually by populist elected rulers who want to turn one section of the country against one another, who pose their conservative anti-immigrant or anti-pluralism values as a national imperative for saving the nation from all sorts of corruption or establishments or threatening international liberal values.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had the Putins of the world, the Recep Tayyip Erdogans of the world, and now the Viktor Orbans of the world saying that we need a strong national, conservative, right-wing, Christian or Muslim or whatever it is, traditional nationalistic political hegemon to guard against all these corrupting influences. And of course, the corrupting influences are human rights, accountability, pluralism, the rule of law, and anything that would constrain their concentrated power, their political project to conquer power and level and eliminate all potential rivals.
So you can't be a populist, nationalist, and Democrat all at the same time.
It's
extremely difficult.
I think that there is a slippery slope between illiberal, right-wing, anti-immigrant, anti-pluralist populism that paints the party leader as the savior of the country, and the political establishment and virtually all political rivals as corrupt betrayal of the real interests of the people. There's a slippery slope between that and the descent into pretty raw authoritarianism, although it happens incrementally. And we've seen the slide happened, I think, fairly rapidly after Putin came to power in 1999, fairly rapidly after Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela around the same time, much more gradually after Erdogan took power in Turkey. You'll recall in the early years,
right.
A lot of us had hope that he would just be a Muslim Democrat in the way that Konrad Adenauer was a Christian Democrat.
Right.
But our liberal friends in Turkey warned that's not who he is,
right.
And that's not what Erdogan's party really represented in Turkey, and they turned out to be right. And so the first ill wind is that you see this process of creeping what we call autocratization, and I've got a different term for it, the autocrat's 12-step program of gradually decimating piece by piece the independence of the judiciary,
the independence of the media, the autonomy of civil society, space for people to criticize the leader, the ability of the business community to support anybody except the ruler and his party. And when you knock those away one by one, pretty soon there's nothing left except the hollow shell of what I think is better termed in Turkey, even in Hungary, certainly increasingly in Russia, and obviously in Venezuela, a pseudo-democracy, if that. So that's the first ill wind. Then you've got Russia and China not content to crack down increasingly on their own populations, because in China, we have China's never been anything close to a democracy since 1949. There was a period of time after Deng Xiaoping rose to power in 1989, I guess it was 79-80, after Deng Xiaoping rose to power, where he began to open up and modernize the system. Mm-hmm. And we had the hope, and I would say now in retrospect, the illusion, that if we drew China in, if we engaged it, if we brought it into the World Trade Organization, as it ultimately came in around a couple decades ago, that China would, as a result of its modernization and as a result of its accession to global institutions and rules, move in at least a politically liberalizing direction, if not become a full democracy. And of course, that is not what has happened. Under Xi Jinping, China has become a much more authoritarian, if not neo-totalitarian state. We have the end of term limits, the concentration relentlessly of political power in Xi Jinping personally, who can now remain as leader of China forever, and a very small cabal around him in the Politburo Standing Committee and the senior ranks of the Chinese Communist Party. Much less freedom of speech, less political pluralism, less of any kind of checks and balances within the Communist Party, and more ideological indoctrination and control. And both of the authoritarian trends within Russia and within China now have much more muscular and ambitious international dimensions of reaching out and trying to reshape the world, reshape norms, reshape global institutions in their own authoritarian images, and even using, in the case of Russia, a hard power to try and undermine the very vulnerable democracy in Ukraine, to pressure other former Soviet states in, I guess, what is called the near abroad, and then to come at the election systems in Europe and the United States. And as we've documented in our very important FSI report in June of this year, to intervene in those elections and try and undermine our actual democratic processes. So these are very, very new and worrisome ill winds for democracy globally that are now blowing from Russia and China.
So that is relatively new, right? That's the argument, that before they may have been focused on oppression at home, but now they're actually exporting these kinds of...
I think it's relatively new for Putin. And of course, it's not that Russia under Putin wasn't doing mischievous things
Good point.
Before 2015 or whatever. We had Russia's invasion of Georgia in the final year of the George W. Bush administration. But I think Putin has become unleashed, if you will.
Yeah, you call it Russian rage. That's a very colorful word, yes.
And much more aggressive and ambitious. And now he's found a very cost-effective way of inflicting damage on democracy through disinformation and the penetration of the electoral space of democracies that we thought was sacred and secure and have discovered it's not. With China, Mike, I think the story is a little bit different. Since coming to power in 1949, and even before, the Chinese Communist Party has had foreign overseas linkages, has had a united front strategy of trying to cultivate ties with sympathetic actors abroad, many of them unwitting in terms of how they were being used, and with members of the now 60 million strong Chinese diaspora around the world. But this has been ramped up and extended under Xi Jinping to a degree that we have never seen before.
Right.
With Chinese influence activities extending into universities, into think tanks, into corporations, into Chinese language media overseas, and certainly into extremely aggressive and I'd say illegal under international law, technology transfer practices that are boldly trying to create a new world of Chinese influence and even Chinese domination by the People's Republic of China.
Let's mention one more ill wind, American complacency. Tell us what you mean by that.
The term American complacency has embedded in it, I think, several strands. One strand is literally that I think we have become, as a people, too much assuming about the security and inevitability of our liberal democracy. So complacent in the expectation that we don't have to worry about democracy, it'll take care of itself. It doesn't require our active attention and participation. Secondly, I think we've become complacent about the rising trends of deterioration in our democracy that particularly may be witnessed in the deepening polarization of our politics.
Right.
Both mass politics, with people becoming so intense in their feelings about parties and politicians that they won't even talk to people from the other side,
right,
or have them at the Thanksgiving dinner table, and with people becoming apathetic about illiberal and intolerant statements on the part of political leaders. And I'm sad to say I don't take joy in having to criticize the sitting president, but some of the statements of our own president that are not consistent with liberal and democratic values and the kind of basic precepts of a tolerant and pluralistic democracy in which everyone is recognized as having the right to speak and have their positions, and in which violence can never be encouraged, condoned, laughed at, or winked at.
And with that happening, just so I understand that kind of argument, it means we are not inspiring others abroad, we're not helping Democrats abroad. You have some prescriptions for what to do next.
I would put it more baldly than that. First of all, we obviously should care about the fate of our own democracy.
Right, good point.
And it's becoming less functional and less capable of addressing our major problems because of the intense level of political polarization.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, as people perceive the dysfunction in American democracy and the apparent declining resolve on the part of the United States, or at least on the part of the elected leadership of the United States, to defend human rights principles and norms abroad, autocrats around the world perceive that they have more license, more space,
right,
to purge their Supreme Courts, crack down on their media, arrest their opponents with the assumption that the United States is not going to condemn them and is not going to impose any costs on their illiberal and authoritarian actions.
Right. Well, let's pivot to some of the good news in your book. One is, I think, was striking that when you look at the public opinion polling that you cite from around the world, there's quite a bit of robust support for democracy. And that suggests that maybe there's something to work with and maybe there's a more bright future for democracy. Obviously, we're talking today at a time when we've seen extraordinary displays of popular will in favor of democracy and human rights in Hong Kong, and just last week also in Russia. Now we just need a big demonstration in America, and we'll be 3 for 3 with your title. But then you also end the book with, I think, some very practical prescriptions for how one might, as the U.S. president, or maybe as a liberal Democrat citizen of the world, might help to reverse some of these ill winds. Why don't we end by...
First of all, I want to echo what you said about the global trend. We sit here at a time when we not only just saw 1.7 million people come out in the rain with remarkable discipline and nonviolence in Hong Kong to continue to protest for their democratic rights and aspirations, but where these young people and others on the streets of Russia's cities just won't stop in protesting deeply fraudulent elections. And you've got a mass movement for democracy in Sudan right now.
Right. Good
that
point.
Is a forced transitional process and the arrest and trial of the former dictator of Sudan. You've got continuing mass mobilization for democracy in Venezuela and a provisional president there courageously resisting a really decadent authoritarian regime. You've got a movement for democracy in Algeria. There's a lot going on. And it is a vivid demonstration of precisely what you said, that if you look at the public opinion polls, there's still overwhelming support at the mass level for democracy as an ideal and a way of governing. On the action side, I think that the United States has to continue to support Democrats around the world, democratic movements, democratic organizations, democratic culture, and carriers of democratic culture in schools and informal networks, and in terms of dispersing the ideas, values, and knowledge of democracy, even through massive open online courses, which I'm trying to develop, and through thumb drives and a variety of innovative means, as well as through the World Wide Web and means of scaling internet censorship to get access to all these democratic knowledge and tools on the internet. And then here in the U.S., I would just note, there is a lot of democratic reform initiative now underway as a result of people coming out to the polls through voter initiatives. Many states are voting out gerrymandering of legislative districts and giving independent commissions the right to redraw legislative district boundaries after the 2020 census. Some are going to work on campaign finance reform. Florida, in a 2018 initiative, just gave convicted felons of nonviolent crimes the right to vote. And Maine became the first state in the United States, again by voter initiative, to adopt ranked choice voting, which I think could be an important step forward in depolarizing our politics. So I see, yes, some very worrisome trends in terms of moving toward unfortunate rhetoric and a kind of polarizing postures by some of our political leaders, but I see a lot of nonpartisan and bipartisan grassroots political reform energy in the United States.
Well, and one very concrete way to regenerate interest in democracy is for people to buy this book.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
And get it translated into all the languages around the world.
Thank you.
It's an extraordinary book, and you should pick it up, and we'll make it available on the website when we put up our podcast, right?
Okay.
Thanks, Larry, for joining
us. Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe and stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.